All right, so hello everyone. My name is Angela Cano, but you can call me Angie because I am aware that Angela is not easy to say, to pronounce. I work as assistant curator at a place that I wanna tell you about. So I'm gonna keep the secret, although I know you already know what I'm talking about. We were talking before that I am from Colombia, but I lived for 10 years in Switzerland, where I did my master's and my PhD. And then just after I finished my PhD, there was this opportunity to work in Cambridge, and I moved to Cambridge, and that was 3 years ago. So I'm just gonna share my screen now, if that's okay. All right, I guess you all see my screen right now. Cool. So this is the place I want to tell you about, and I hope you have all visited it already at some point, maybe not during the last months, but hopefully you have, because I mean, it's still open. And I guess that we all agree that this is a beautiful place, right? If I show you this other picture, I mean, look at that beautiful glass house with the plantings. It's a lovely symmetry. And this is one of the most famous areas of this place that looks like a park, right? It doesn't look like a museum. It looks much more like a park. When we see this other picture, also beautiful, we start getting the idea that we are not in any kind of park. And there's actually some structure there, and maybe the idea of a collection. And if we zoom in a little bit more, like where the grasses are, we find that there is interpretation. So that is one of the interpretation panels. And there are some labels there. So we now get a better idea that this is actually some sort of museum, but made of very different masterpieces than what we usually find. And these are living organisms that are plants, right? So we are at a botanic garden, which is more similar to a museum than to a park. Now, can anyone tell me what plant is next to the interpretation panel?
Corn?
Maize?
Exactly. Well done. That's corn. Well done, Chris. That was an easy one for some of you, maybe not to all of you. That was just a quiz. And at the garden, because we are not any kind of park where people just go there to have some free time and to enjoy the view, we have three different missions. We have the ideas to support research, education, and conservation projects, and to conduct these activities ourselves too, right? So at the garden, we are divided into different teams to be able to achieve these different missions. So we have an administration team, which is quite large. We have a learning team, and then we have the horticulture team, which I have to disclose this. They are in charge of keeping our masterpieces alive. They are extremely important and very skilled professionals. And then there's the weird team of curation, and that's where I work. And so we actually don't really know how to keep plants alive. We know where they are distributed in the wild, which species are important, and how to manage the collections. And so today, what I'm gonna tell you about is how my job is at the garden. How do we manage the collections and the different things that involve my work at the garden. And of course, we all interact. All of these teams are closely interacting, especially curation and horticulture. So the idea after this slide is to show the difference between what a visitor sees when they come to the garden, right? You have these icons here of people just enjoying the garden and learning from maybe the interpretation, enjoying the view, and what we as curators see when we look at the garden. We look at a very structured system where we have very different processes and protocols that we want to improve all the time and we want to follow. And so I'm gonna tell you about some of these processes. Of course, this is just gonna be a 15-20 minutes talk, and I can't tell you, and I'm sure you wouldn't like to know about each of these processes, but I want to tell you about the ones that I think are the most significant for us. And so just to explain quickly this kind of workflow diagram, at the garden we have actually four collections. The most important one are the living plants, but we also have a seed bank, a herbarium, and a library. And so that's what we call the collections, and that's what we manage as a curation team. And the in blue you have the different processes that we accomplish. And maybe let's move to the next slide and I can start telling you about this process that is, it has been very important to me since I started working at the garden, because the curator Sam Brockington and I spend a lot of time looking at our collection and the data that we can extract from it and measuring key characteristics that allow us to understand which areas we are doing correctly and which ones can be improved, and how we can achieve or get closer to the goal of supporting research, conservation, and education projects, right? So let me tell you a little bit about this. And first of all, I have to tell you about our database. So whenever you are at the garden, I'm sure you have seen these labels. And as I was writing in the description of this talk, it's a very qualified label, right? We have a lot of information there. And this one is particularly crowded in information. So in this label, you find the Latin name of a given plant. This is a palm. I really like palms. Then you have here the family where that plant is classified. So in botany, we tend to use families as a taxonomic level, that is the most common to use. And then here we have a number that is what we call the accession number. And it's the same thing that you see in form of QR code. And so when you scan it or when you look for that number you in the database, you'll find all this information about this plant. The other thing you see here is the common name of the plant, which is sometimes there or not in the label, because not all plants have English common names. They all have Latin names because that's the standard way we use as scientists to refer to a species. And then if the plant is somehow, the distribution of the plant is also written in the label. So in this case, we have an endemic plant to Madagascar. So it's a plant that is only found in Madagascar. And then if the species is threatened somehow at a different level, that information will be also recorded in this label. So in this case, this is a critically endangered species. We also have species that are not threatened at all, that are quite common, that are at other levels of endangerment or threatening. And then the last part is this code that tells us where the specimen that we have at the garden comes from. So in this case, it's one that where the seeds came from the wild. So this is this brings the original genetic information that is found in the wild population. Sometimes we have here a G instead, which means garden. So it was maybe bought from another garden or grown in another garden or bought from a nursery. Sometimes we have a U here, which means unknown. So those are plants that that's rare to find nowadays. But at the beginning, when 200 years ago, when they started planting the trees, especially of the garden, some were not recorded. The origin was not recorded, and some for some species we don't know where they come from. But anyway, so this label is actually an interpretation for the public and for us, the people that work with the plants, of what is in the database. So it's a window to the database, and the database contains the information of every single plant we grow at the garden. Right now we have more than 14,000 plants that are growing at the garden. So you can imagine it's a treasure, this database, and we can interpret a lot of information from it. And so one of my missions at the garden is to crack that data and to find how we are improving or how we are changing and what we could do better. So for example, this is a chart that I produced recently where we see the different origins I told you about: wild, unknown, G, as that means it came from the wild, and then this is the second generation, so it was grown at the garden, so it's not anymore the original genetic pool of the wild population, but is the closest to it that we have. And so here you see that in the last 10 years, the number of plants coming from garden origin has increased, but also the number of wild origin has increased too. And this is what we aim for. We want to have more wild derived plants at the garden, because if we want to support research, we want to give researchers the original genetic pool of the species. Because in gardens, it can happen that if you're growing two closely related species, they can hybridize and then produce seeds, but maybe they are not, then you'll have mixed genetic information. So it's the longer a plant is grown at the garden, the lower its purity in quotation marks, right? So that's one of the things I do. The other thing is also to look at where the plants that we grow come from and which areas of the world are better represented in our collection. So this is showing like the darkest the squares. It means that we have a lot of species in that particular area. So of course, we grow a lot of things from the UK, we grow a lot of things from the UK and from Europe in general. But we also have a lot of species from North America, Australia, New Zealand. We have a specific area of the garden of New Zealand flora. But there are other areas that we are completely underrepresenting, like the Amazon, for example. That's a place that, and it makes sense, right? Because if you look at the things that we grow at the garden, it's mostly things that we can grow outdoors. Our glass houses are restricted in space, and outdoors we have much more room to grow things that are from temperate regions. So it makes sense that we grow those more than tropical elements. Right, so we evaluate the collection And we spent a lot of time doing that in the pad since I started to produce a collection strategy that we launched. I wanted to say last year, but it's last year was like, if it didn't happen, it wasn't at the end of 2019. And if you are interested in looking at our collection strategy for the next 10 years, you can go to our website. Here's the link. I can post it in the chat later and look at the document that we produced, which I think is quite comprehensive. And in there, we established different goals that we have for the next 10 years to achieve those goals that we, those missions that I mentioned at the beginning, support education, conservation, and research, and how to do it. And so that's another thing that we have been working on recently. And one of the goals is to make our collections really accessible to the public and to scientists and to educators. So we also recently launched this Living Collections portal. So if you go to our website too, you have this, or you reach this portal where you can look for plants that we grow at the garden. And for example, if you're interested in Saxifraga cochlearis, you have some information about it. So for example, these species that we grow at the garden, it comes from, it's originally distributed in France and Italy. And we collected it in 1974 from the wild. So this was probably a seedling or some seeds, some cuttings of a plant that was in the wild and that we brought. And you'll see also some photos of the plant. And not all of the plants in the portal have photos, but a lot of them have. And so if you look at this image, it says that I've requested it. So because if you are a scientist or you can show some affiliation to an academic institution, you can get samples from our collection or photos or different information. So you can, this is like Amazon, but for plants that we grow at the garden. So you can pick different species and have a request list and then send it to us and we will process it. And if you have your accreditation, then we can send you samples or the material you need. So this makes our collections really accessible. And before this, we already were doing the same, offering samples to researchers or other interests, but this has facilitated the access to people because it's there, it's online, you can search yourself, and then it's very easy for us to get your requests. And now I'm not gonna spend a lot of time telling you about this collection strategy, but in these three areas that I mentioned, research, conservation, and education, we want to improve different aspects. So for example, in research, we want to include, to increase rarity, we want to reduce redundancy, so that's to avoid having the same species multiple times at the garden. We want to increase the diversity of genera and families. For example, we want to have all the different families, plant families that exist. In the conservation category, we want to have, in the next 10 years, we want to get material and grow at the garden all the species that are considered extinct in the wild. That's what EEW means. So these are plants that are grown at other botanic gardens or other collections, and we want to have them all represented in our collection. And then maybe what's important to you, because we are at a global food security talk, right, is economically important plants. So right now at the garden, we grow a lot of, like I showed earlier, the corn plant. We grow a lot of economically important plants. And this is useful for researchers, but mostly for education, because we want to let people know what is used in not only in the typical species that we use in Europe, but maybe in other parts of the world, how they are used, why they are important, and also for research. If I mean, nowadays it's so important to get living material to sequence DNA or other proteins and study the molecules in plants. So that's, we want to increase the number of economically important plants, and also to have a better to improve the content, the information that we have in our database. It's called IRIS-BG, to improve the education that we deliver at the garden. And so those were two very important processes that we conducted at the garden recently, but I'm sure you are here also to talk about the most interesting part, in my opinion, which is the sourcing of plants. And so that's something that I am in charge of. So I am often joined by other colleagues at the garden, but we have two different ways to source plants, to bring them to the garden, to the collection. So one is to contact other collections like botanic gardens or seed banks. And for example, there's this huge network of botanic gardens in the world called Botanic Garden Conservation International. And they have a database where you can just search for a species and see which gardens have them and request perhaps seeds or plantings or seedlings from them or cuttings. And then you have them different seed banks, but the most famous one and the one that we collaborate the most is the Millennium Seed Bank, because it's right next to Cambridge, right? And the other, the real fun part, is the field work. So because we really are interested in bringing wild material and also interesting material for research, for in conservation and education, it's, as I said earlier, very important to get the original genetic pool. So since I started working at the garden, I've been to many different places for different reasons. So the first trip I did was to South Africa, and that's the previous photo was there. So in this very dry environment, the desert in the north of South Africa, occur loads of different succulent plants. So I don't know if you can tell, but the mountains behind are of a different mineral than the ones in front. So they are darker here, and here they are a bit more yellow. And all these differences in the substrate means that different species can grow there. And this region is full of different substrates. So it's full of endemic species in each of those different mountains. So with my colleague, Alex Summers, and a colleague from Kew Gardens, Paul Rees, we went there in 2018 to collect mainly succulent plants for the garden and for different research projects. But I've also been to different places, Vietnam last year, where the goal was to collect specially endangered species of magnolias and rhododendrons. And this is a very, very, it's a critically endangered magnolia species called Magnolia grandis that we managed to find in the wild with some seeds, and we are hoping to get some germination soon. It's been planted already for a year and it's waiting to germinate. Apparently the seeds are still vigorous and still viable, but sometimes it's take a while to germinate. I've been to Switzerland to collect seeds of alpine plants with the Geneva Botanic Garden because I used to work with them, and they invited us to be part of a yearly expedition that they take to find seeds for their own seed bank. And anyway, I won't tell you about each of these expeditions, but this is just to illustrate part of my work and the different purposes of these trips. And then, yeah, maybe to highlight why we do all these. This is a paper that my boss, Sam Brockington, published not too long ago, where they took from that huge database, BGCI, different information, and their take-home message was that in botanic gardens, we grow about 30% of all plants that are known. So that's a third of the plants in the world, and they are kept at botanic gardens. And that's very impressive. And also 41% of all the known threatened species. So we do play a very important role in terms of conservation and just offering to the public, to the researchers, the material they can use for their purpose, their researches. And so I hope that next time that you visit the garden, you keep us take home message that although it looks gorgeous and the horticulturists at the garden do an amazing job making everything look symmetric and beautiful, behind it, there's a lot of work, a lot of data recording, tracking, and management. And you'll see the value of our collections a bit more clearly. That's it.
Thank you so much, Angela. I love the Botanic Gardens, and thank you so much for this overview. I wanted to ask you just very quickly two questions. You said economically important plants. What do you mean by that? And also, what would you say is the percentage, in a way, of the eating plants or plants, you know, that produce food that the gardens curate? I was looking at the map that you showed us, and I was thinking of orphan crops, and I'm thinking, is there some strategy towards that too?
Yeah, so economically important is any species that is used for a given purpose by humans. Because, I mean, let's be honest, the majority of the plants are not used by people because there are so many species. There are about 400,000 species of plants in the world, and not all of them are used by people. So only those that are used are called economically important, and they can be used to eat them, or to build structures with them, or to, I don't know, for medicinal purposes. So everything that is used from every species that is used for a purpose is called an economically important plant. Now, I can't really tell you, I don't know what the percentage of economically important plants we grow at the garden. I don't have that statistic with me right now. I would say that we have 14,000 plants and 8,000 species. A minority is useful plants and crops, I would say. We do have things that they're quite common, like sugar cane, the corn, especially in those systematic beds. We have more useful plants. I can cite many different examples, but I don't really know the percentage of that they represent in our collection.
Thank you, Angela. Michelle, please.
Yes, Thank you, Angela, for the interesting presentation. I have a question for you. I mean, I've never visited the Botanic Garden in Cambridge, unfortunately.
Where are you located?
I'm based in Morocco, so okay. I work in Morocco.
Okay, then that excuses you.
Yeah, well, it works. So I saw it. It looks to me like in the first picture that you have shown that it's like a tiny garden in a complete forest of urbanization and in a sea of urbanization and I don't know, maybe pollution. Have you done or any, is there any data about the evolution of your conservation strategies with climate change? I mean, there must be species that you have lost during the last few years because you can't grow them anymore, or maybe you can grow some others. And so that was my first question. And my second question is embedded more into the one of your comments. You stated it looks more like a park. You know, we need to avoid that people think of botanic gardens as just a park, but rather a research and an active research going on there. So what kind of interaction do you have with the university in Cambridge and that, more specifically and at large, what are the interaction you have with broader networks? I mean, do you receive requests from other universities or research centers about specific things that you conserve? And how do you see that role of botanic gardens besides
it's extremely important. So first of all, I mean, to be small or large is relative, right? So I can just give you the size of the garden, 16 hectares. Compared to the size of Cambridge, I would say it's not that small, but probably next to other botanic gardens is
no, that's not that small, indeed. Yeah, it's not that small. But it looked to me small. That's why I said that I've never visited before.
Yeah, that's okay. The first picture I showed was only showing half of the garden. But that's just to clarify, we are not that tiny. And then regarding your question about climate change and if we have lost lost species because of climate change, we are currently doing different analysis, perhaps not to evaluate if we have lost things, but to predict which species we could bring to the garden, given the prediction of how climate will be in the next years. And so that applies specifically more to trees than to other types of plants, because of course those are the plants that live for longer. So yes, I am working on doing analysis similar to what has been done in Australia, where they have terrible problems at different botanic gardens with climate change, and they have modeled which plants they could grow there. So if you have a map of the world that with some specific climatic conditions predicted, you can see, okay, maybe I can find some species from those regions that will be easy or viable to grow at Cambridge. So that's one of the projects I'm working on, and the other one is to measure our carbon content in at the garden. How much carbon do we stock at the garden, and if it's valuable at the Cambridge level, if it's some interesting pool of carbon that we have at the garden. And then your second, it's definitely very important for people to understand the difference between a botanic garden and a park. I tend to start always saying that the place is beautiful, just to break the conversation to the other side and say, actually, we are not there to be beautiful. We are there because we have those three missions and that we want to accomplish. And if you Let me just find quickly the collection strategy, because we have there some maps where we show the interactions that we have with at the national level, at the European level, and at the global level with other collections. Because I mean, now we have that portal I mentioned about, where people can request material. So a lot of people from Cambridge University and around Cambridge University request material from us. But because we are part of BGCI, we also get a lot of requests from there. And when my boss, Sam Brockington, started, one of his main goals was to reply to each of those requests that we get from BGCI, because what often happens is that researchers go to BGCI and they send this email that is sent is blank. You don't really know as a scientist where your request is being sent to. You just know that some gardens have a given plant and you send it blindly. And most of the time, gardens don't reply because they don't have the staff that can take care of those requests. But since Sam started, one of his goals was to reply to each of those requests. So we have been sending material to a lot of different places. So I can try to find that information. It will take me a minute just to show you those maps. I think it's worth it because I'll share my screen.
Okay. So Angie, I think botanic gardens are underfunded everywhere, right?
Yeah. Yes, because I mean, that's the thing.
Is it because people don't understand the importance, you think, that there is not enough interest? You know, we talk so much about climate change, so much funding, but then it seems to me that there's a big gaps in actually really being serious somehow, right?
The thing is that botanic gardens are often more viewed as parks and entertainment places than as research places, and they often depend on governmental funding for their function. And so of course they it's really hard for botanic gardens to get the funding, and I mean, it is especially true for countries where most of the biodiversity exists, like I don't know, all the different biodiversity hotspots. So a biodiversity hotspot is defined as a place that has a lot of species and that are highly threatened. And often there's a lot of endemism. And those places are the poorest ones. And they don't even have local botanic gardens. And so it's not easy to sell the goals of a botanic garden and to survive as a botanic garden and to get funding. That's why in some very rich countries like Switzerland, in Geneva, for example, the botanic garden is for free. You don't need to pay anything to access the botanic garden because they depend on the government and they have funding for their research and for their and to maintain their collections. But in other places, it's important for the garden to be able to offer also some entertainment to people, to common people, to as a trade-off for an economical gain. So I found that image I was looking for, and this is where we show in the last, I don't really know when this started. I think it's all the different exchanges we've had with other countries and other cities at the UK level. So I hope I've replied your question, Michelle.
Thank you, Michelle. Anyone else would like to make a comment or ask a question? I was bringing in Diane before, just because, Diane, I'm putting you on the spot now. Thinking of kind of how archaeology feeds into the decision of curating. So, you know, looking at the past effectively and looking at what we're losing, then that perhaps might inform you. in your decision? Or am I sort of asking a completely odd question?
No, I'm not sure I can fully answer it, but I'll try. So just to give you background, I work on crop land races to look for the movement of agriculture during prehistory, but working on extant land races. So I work a lot with seed banks. The conservation, so it's more seed banks I'll be working with than botanic gardens. But what's really wonderful about the Cambridge Botanic Garden is you're growing various things like maize, like broom corn millet and barley and the different wheats. So that's just fantastic for us and for students, to archaeology students, to come and visit the garden and see what these crops actually look like. And we've also, I think, used stuff from Botanic Gardens for reference, the reference collection. So we have a large archaeobotanical reference collection, which is sort of economic plants from all over the world. We've got stuff from Cambridge Botanic Garden, but other botanic gardens and seed collections as well. That's just two aspects of what's really important, archaeology. The reference collection side, it's really, really important for us to have a real diversity of things in our reference collection that really represent the diversity of things that are found in the archaeological record as well. I was just going to say, Francesca, was there other elements to your question?
No, I mean, I thought I was thinking more of kind of you informing the decision making of botanic gardens, looking at the past, effectively in almost like an itinerary.
I mean, there's always the possibility. We often get requests from scientists at the university or from elsewhere to grow specific plants in our collections because they could need them for a given reason. And so one of my goals is to source those plants from different sources, not necessarily those that are crops, not necessarily from the wild, but from, because they are crops. We don't need to start an expedition to go there. But yeah, exactly. If you need to increase the references that you need for your work, yes. And the other way I think there could be interaction is we do give courses about recognizing plants and how to differentiate the different families and how plants are classified. So maybe that could be a way to...
That would be really valuable. We don't have so many botanists in the department. Well, I mean, Martin Jones is retired and selected, but... so the teaching of the botanicals, archaeobotany, as it's called, or paleoethnobotany, is increasing. But I think it would be really, really valuable to have a link. Actually, if we could somehow be notified of those sorts of courses, I think it would be really good for the archaeology department.
You know where to find me.
Yeah, exactly, I do.
Perfect. I'll put you in touch so you can start something. Great. That would be wonderful. anyone else would like to make a comment or ask a question to Angela or anyone else in the group? No? No questions, I think. No more comments. One very final comment, Angela, I wanted to ask you. I suppose there is, of course, but when you sort of talk to other botanic gardens, is there a comparison on how the same plant is being performing in different environments, especially if it wasn't a native from that specific botanic gardens? I imagine it kind of start reacting differently, and it would be, I suppose, interesting to see what kind of reactions it has and how it adapts. Do you have this kind of exchange of information and data?
Yes, we do interact with our colleagues for that. I mean, we have, because the way Botanic Gardens work is almost altruistic completely, because we all are underfunded and everything that we exchange is for free. We don't charge anything from our exchanges. We are very keen to sharing information of all kinds, so information of where our plants come from and how we manage to germinate some species. And but that's more so the conditions to grow a given species is more of the knowledge of the horticulturists, and they are often in contact with colleagues from other botanic gardens and other institutions. And we, in our database, whenever it's possible, we do include that information. And we can also tell, for example, when a seed was planted and how long it took before it germinated. And it's, I have to say that we need to improve that recording of conditions. But that's again a problem, like a compromise between how much the horticulturalists can spend, how much time they can spend annotating things in the database, and the actual horticultural work, which is quite demanding.
I can imagine.
That's part of the collection strategies, to increase the information that we keep for each plant at the garden.
Yeah. Do you have volunteering positions in your? I mean, I know that there are probably volunteering positions helping out at events, but specifically in your area.
I'm just wondering if
anyone here in the group would like actually to help outside of their working space.
Definitely. So at the moment, it's a bit complicated to work with volunteers, because we are not even going to the garden right now, most of us in curation. But yeah, we have many different volunteers. For example, we have a volunteer that takes photos, that she comes once a week to the garden, and she takes photos of the plants that are flowering especially flowering at a given point, and she links them to the database. That's a basic thing that we do, but it's very important to increase the number of photos we have. Another thing, another volunteer helps us with mounting herbarium specimens. So those are, when we grow a plant at the garden that is used for research, we take a sample that shows the morphology of the plant with the leaves, the flowers, etc. And we dry it and we press it and we dry it. And then that plant has to be mounted in a paper that is acid free, and then we keep it in the herbarium. And that mounting process, that is very delicate, it's done by one of our technicians, but also by volunteers. It was done when things were different. Hopefully they will begin.
No. Yes, exactly, when we go back to normality.
Yeah, but we also have, sometimes when we have specific projects, we have volunteers for databasing specific things. So for increasing the content of the database. And so yes, if you are interested in that, do get in touch.
Yeah,
I can put my email in the chat.
Please do put the email in the chat, and anyone who would like to do some volunteering, there's more than volunteering in a museum with paintings or, in a charity. You can also do it at Botanic Gardens. Great. Thank you so much, Angela.
The link to the collection strategy.
Thank you. I'll also put it on the website anyway.
That would be great.
Yes, for sure. And so I'll share your slides and the recording on our website. You'll have to have, for the recording, you'll have to have the Raven's account, but otherwise everything else will be on the page. Wonderful. If there are no other questions or comments before we close and wrap up, last chance. Bye. Wonderful. Thank you so much. Have a good weekend. Thank you. Thank you again.
Thank you so much for inviting me. This was fun.
Thank you.
Bye.
Bye-bye.